So you've meant a lot to me personally.
And my kids don't say that.
Of course your kids aren't going to say that to you. But no, I grew up in New York City. I looked up to Eliot Spitzer and Wiener as like chutzpah-filled Jewish energy and like not the greatest idols to have at like 15, 16 years old. And all of a sudden, like, you know, you're here, you're still doing it, and you're still being yourself. So like, thank you for kind of existing in this space. So you and she share something in common. You're both Faust fans. So during the Cultural Revolution, there are puff pieces written about him today that say that he walked 30 miles to get the book out of the library. He was reading it with a kerosene lamp.
So who's Mephisto?
Oh no, so in 2014, he said that America thinks China is Mephisto. He's in Germany. This was one of his lines.
Well, he's surely taken it to heart.
Yeah, no, apparently it's like when he does things like this, he's got books behind him every year too. And every year Goethe makes it behind him for his like annual
Oh,
address.
really?
Yeah, no, it's a
Is
real
it?
thing.
Is that the only Western one that does?
No. So
What else?
the American ones, we've got Leaves of Grass, Huckleberry Finn, Jack London, Old Man and the Sea. He said every time he goes to Cuba, he orders a mojito in honor of Hemingway.
You know, I was at Hemingway's house in Havana
Yeah.
when I went to Havana. You know, those are that's an interesting group of literature to understand a cultural perspective. We do share that.
You have to be idealistic enough to know what you're doing and ruthless enough to get it done.
Correct. That's what leadership is.
Has the U.S. been ruthless enough with respect to China?
So let me back up, having authored that quote. It was in response to how do you define leadership? And I think if you look at great leaders, they're idealistic enough to know why they're doing what they're doing, and ruthless or tough enough then to get it done. And leadership, leaders, effective leaders, people that have taken of note, are those who do both. A lot of times, journalists, commentators, historians talk about one side as if that's the defining characters, but you can have all the ideas you want, but if you don't have the capability to see one through, and if all you do is see one through, but you don't know why you're doing what you're doing or where it's leading to. So there's a compass to this as well as a perseverance to this. So I do think the United States, not consistently, one, on President Biden, particularly given I'm serving now, has a real vision, and we're in the middle. You and I are doing this meeting 2 weeks out from the state visit, where I think we're transforming our relationship in the region from a hubs and spokes to this lattice-like work system. If you look at the last 2 years of whether it's encouraging Japan to step up on the security front, encouraging the trilateral relationship, a re-energized Quad. At the back end of our state visit by Japan, we'll have a first-ever trilateral with the Philippines, the AUKUS, you look at Vietnam. This lattice work architecture, it's a vision, it's a set of ideas, and it's been with a perseverance and determination led by the president in direct response to, I think, China's mistakes and in their own neighborhood, in their own backyard, which is actually a fundamental principle of theirs, which is China, Russia, the United States, as superpowers should have their own spheres of influence. What I think gets at them is that in their own backyard, their sphere of influence is limited by their mistakes and are taking advantage of it. So, is it ruthless enough? The president, I don't know if I would use ruthless as the author of that word, but he has been persistent in pursuing a singular goal with a single-mindedness. And if you look at where we were 5 years ago and how people like you were talking about the United States, and you look at us today, I'd rather have our hand the way we're playing it than China's hand the way they're playing it.
Sure. We'll come back to the Alliance Network in a second. But I think the sort of, you know, the more direct coercive actions on China when it comes to limiting, you know, investment or October 7th, you know, pursuing decoupling, you know, not from the promote side, but from more of the protect side. I think there are folks out there, perhaps myself included, who see roads not taken when it comes to being more aggressive and disentangling the U.S. and China, particularly from a
Well, I so let me step back and, you know, I can't believe I'm taking this approach, but for the rare moment to be the more thoughtful here. One is not to be so aggressive that all you have is aggression. I think the United States, I wouldn't say has the luxury, but should be strategic enough to decide, since we're in baseball season, which pitches to swing at and which ones you don't swing at. And just to say your road's not taken, well, you don't have to take every road. If you took every road, you wouldn't go anywhere fast.
Sure.
So I think it's taking the right roads or swinging at the right pitches, the ones that count, the ones that have strategic value. I think the biggest change I would say, or if I can say two notes, China has a basic premise. One, that they are the rising power, we're a declining power, and either you get in line or you're going to get the Philippine treatment. That's basically, you could distill it all down here in the neighborhood. Our message is we are a permanent Pacific power and presence, and you can bet long on us. And I think when you look back at the two of those, we have made more of a down payment and are in a stronger position on our basic premise than they are. And the other piece of this, on the flip side, we did stay too long with the idea that China was a strategic competitor when they had changed by 2013 using what Xi had said, going back to your first quote, where they approached the United States as a strategic adversary. And not really, you can maybe say Trump, but not until President Biden put in place the things that he has done, both on the diplomatic side, the defense side, the deterrence side, the political side, did we have an effective strategy to deal with China's decision to approach the United States as an adversary rather than a competitor?
So Japan and Korea, I think, you know, from my mind, the most impressive accomplishment in American diplomacy over this administration. How did it happen? What lessons should future, you know, leaders learn from this, and maybe compare it to, you know, Clinton's diplomacy and getting other people who really hate each other to get along?
Well, you know, a lot of people, so I want to, not that you were saying this, to dispel something. Some people think diplomacy is right over here, gray flannel suit, pipes, big thoughts. And some people think there's this dirty thing called politics over here. The fact is, diplomacy is politics by just another name. And one of the lessons to take away from this is that President Biden showed great appreciation in building personal relations with both President Yoon and Prime Minister Kishida, and gave them then the confidence to go past doing the bare minimum. And that's an outgrowth of that. Second is actually, this is, if you look at past efforts of every other president who's tried this in administration, we put ourselves so far in the middle that Japan and Korea didn't talk to each other. And to the credit of the State Department, the President, the National Security Office, the ambassadors, Phil Goldberg, myself, we held, going into Camp David a year out, almost 50 different trilateral gatherings at multiple different levels that people started to get, you know, at those trilateral gatherings, you have a lot of bilaterals. And Japan and Korea, you know, deputy foreign ministers, national security advisors, defense, they had meetings. And the constant contact created familiarity. And Camp David was the culmination of a year's worth of trilateral meetings at multiple levels where you're then having breakfast or lunch or coffee with your counterpart. And we didn't have to be in everything. Our role was more, at one level, not all, facilitate, but not let the two parties talk to each other through us. And that showed, maturity in how we approach our role rather than kind of jumping into the deep end all the time. Sometimes we did, but a lot of times we didn't. The other piece of it is, I think appreciating, you know, if you could, this is somewhat separate but relevant, is Prime Minister Kishida had a background with the 2015 agreement with Korea. President Yoon's father comes to Japan in the 60s to study.
Yeah.
Well, if you're here from Korea in the 60s, you're like a pioneer. And so both of them had a personal relationship beyond just professional. And they both realized, given what was going on with both China and North Korea, they had to do more than what the two countries were doing. We wanted to do more. And I think so when you put all those different threads together, you got something going.
Very briefly, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed my trip to Japan and would love a financial excuse to continue recording shows on the country. If you work at JETRO, METI, the Japan Foundation, Mitsubishi, I don't know, Rakuten, and are interested in seeing more deep coverage of Japan, Japan's tech scene, and U.S.-China-Japan relations on this podcast, please reach out.
Is there a downside of over-indexing on leader-to-leader contact and personal relationships?
Like, give me the definition of what you mean by that.
I'm thinking about Biden and Netanyahu.
And what are you trying to get at?
The idea that, you know, I think, you know, yourself and the president today sees that a lot can be done with sort of leader-to-leader contact and personal relationships.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in it, and I'll give you one anecdote story. So when President Clinton, early in his tenure of his first term, Richard Nixon, I think, makes his first trip back to the White House ever. Clinton meets with him. One of the advices that Nixon gives Clinton is, don't ever underestimate the power of the personal relationship. The State Department can't pick up the phone, as I think he used the anecdote, get Hosni Mubarak on the phone and say, I need this, this, and this as the President of the United States. And he's going to, if you have that relationship, he's going to owe you one because you've done X, Y, and Z for him. And can it do everything? Can it smooth over everything? No. Is it at crucial moments valuable to have that personal relationship and that personal experience and that trust? Yeah. Without a doubt, 100%. And I've seen it many, many times, whether it was on President Clinton's side, in many crucial moments, whether it's the Mideast, when we navigated India and Pakistan. Yeah. I've seen it by President Obama on different pieces of his tenure. So it's not everything. But as my grandfather would say, it's not bupkis either.
I guess I'm thinking about like Stalin convincing himself that because he knew Hitler, he wasn't going to invade.
Well, that wasn't the first kind of anecdote I was going to go through.
But no, I mean, I think leaders can convince themselves because they have relationships with other people.
Oh, understand. I thought you were saying to move them to do something. That's a different. You're asking about did Stalin understand Hitler, and therefore, because of the personal thing, Hitler, he knew enough about Hitler that Hitler would not do something.
Or just you blind yourself to other inputs because you think you have a relationship.
Sure, sure. Well, everybody does. That's human.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do, but I do think in foreign policy, and not just foreign policy, in politics. Politics is a people's business.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to use business, but it's a people relationship. And if you build up levels of trust, it can be a tremendous asset. Can you be blinded and disappointed? Well, it's human relationships. Anybody can be disappointed. Yeah. That's not breaking news. You're not going to get a live feed at 10 o'clock. Diplomats and political leaders misread each other all the time. Yeah. I do think the successful foreign leader engagement is to understand what is the other person's politics. Even if you're an authoritarian government, they have politics. They have domestic interests. They have different pressure points. And if you can appreciate theirs, and obviously having a full appreciation of your own, a successful leader will understand that and see if they can find where that not happy medium is, but where A, either there's a win, or B, is not so costly a stretch.
Sure. So let's take that and come back to China then. I think, you know, I was reading some China books coming over here. John Dower.
China, you were reading books?
Japan books.
China books, you were on the way over here?
No.
To this meeting?
I read your brother's memoir. I read the Mayer book. We did a lot of prep for this. Okay. I was thinking about, like, what America would really love to happen is, like, an embracing defeat moment for China. Where, you know, they don't have to lose, hopefully they don't have to lose a World War III to get there, but that sort of mindset between how China, you know, between what China's goals are in the world has a pretty fundamental shift in one that is much more kind of like amenable with where the rest of the world wants to take it. How do we get there, Ram?
Well, here's my, look, I mean, I'm not going to give, now that I know President Xi likes American literature, I may have some books for him to read. And maybe that will save that for my Hanukkah gift.
No, please. What are you going to assign him? This is great.
No, I'm going to think about really good books for him in American literature. Let's find out his birthday. We'll send him some books over to the embassy.
Okay.
So President Xi comes in 2012. He has a choice. It's, you know, to quote Yogi Berra, when you get to a fork in the road, take it. There's the Mao Zedong Road and the Deng Xiaoping Road. And he rejects Deng Xiaoping. And the biggest thing that he does isn't so much as crushing private sector or favoring the state control, etc. China's quite an entrepreneurial culture, and he crushed their entrepreneurship. And in crushing their entrepreneurship and the tactics he adopted, he crushed the confidence of the world in China. Now he's, as you and I are sitting here talking, he's holding a conference with business leaders, mainly U.S., but others from around the world, hoping to encourage them to come back. It's very hard to have people come back and invest when you're arresting them.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know what, you know, 20 years, 10 years ago, you used to get people in companies out, raise their hand, say, okay, I want to move to Beijing or Shanghai or whatever, moved with their offices. You can't get anybody in Japan, Europe, or et cetera, or the United States. Employees raise their hand and say, I would like to move my family to a city where I could get arrested any given day and be in lockdown. So they have now lost the confidence of the world. What he did, and rising youth unemployment, massively declining foreign investment, and China did not lift hundreds of million of people out of poverty. The international system that China was a part of enabled China to do that. They followed smart policies at home, but the international system of which they were probably the singular greatest beneficiary, they walked, turned their back on. And when they turned their back on, guess what? The rest of the world started to turn, or at least the developed world that they cared about started turning their back. It's like, okay, how many times are you going to have somebody just turn their back on you? How many times are you going to have somebody steal your intellectual property or create economic espionage or arrest your citizens cavalierly? So I think our desire would be, if you want to come back into the system, be part of a responsible stakeholder, have your voice heard and contribute, great. If you want to turn your back on it and be self-sufficient to the point that the rest of the world is literally pushed away, that you'll have the own domestic consequences in China. And that's the part of China that they're most scared about. They're not. They're scared of the United States. They're scared of the neighborhood, a collective unified neighborhood. They're very scared of the Chinese people. And they have a reason to be scared of the Chinese people, because they have failed to deliver the very fundamental premise: you give us security and power, we'll give you the access to the Chinese dream, and they have crushed it.
That line is a lever that a lot of American politicians are less comfortable pushing on. Being explicit about domestic unrest being something that's like an American...
Well, it's not in our interest. I didn't say it was our... They made a choice, and it has consequences. In China, they're arresting their entrepreneurs. They're pushing them out of the country. Facts. The number fourth ethnic group that is coming at the southwest border, coming over the southwest border of the United States, is Chinese. That's a $30,000 trip. That is not the rural poor of China. Here in, somebody told me, I don't know if it to be true or not true, here in Japan, in Tokyo, any apartment or condo above $2 million has a Chinese bidder on it. They're the major real estate buyer in Hokkaido. People are getting their money out. They're leaving. Entrepreneurs are not starting businesses. Youth unemployment, you know, whether they want to report accurate data or not, it doesn't change the fact that there's a high propensity of unemployed youth in China. Capital is fleeing. So at some point, and there was 10 years ago a different economic structure in China. It wasn't just built on debt. It was built on entrepreneurship. It was built on the world having confidence in China's future and willing to invest in it. China decided not to have that. Okay, I can't stop you from hurting yourself. I tried, but you won't listen.
So I guess maybe one more time, like if she will say she's a lost cause, like what else can America and its allies be doing to make sure that the next person, when they see that fork in the road, you know, chooses a different direction?
Well, first of all, part of leadership is knowing what you can do and what you can't do. The price in China right now is cognizant on the Chinese. They know the economy's not doing well. They know their youth are unemployed. They know that people aren't getting homes. They know the fact is that the future generation has very little confidence in the Chinese dream or the Chinese Communist Party able to deliver it. That's going to be one of the biggest holds on China. I've always said there's three Chinas. There's a core China. It's called the three C's. The core is calm. The relationship between the PRC and the people of China, they want calm. And they're very nervous about it. The second ring is the conflict ring, which is China in the neighborhood. India, Philippines, Japan. They're in constant conflict. And then there's the outer ring, which is what they call the charm China. It's a win-win. We just want people to get along, etc. And all those are in conflict with each other. I mean, by way of example, China's trying to convince our Western business leaders to invest in China so they can have the calm China. Yet, we just discovered, not only ourselves but the UK, incredible cyber attacks generated by the Chinese government in our two respective countries. That's the conflict China. And the conflict and charm China are not the same, or as I like to say yesterday, they're very rarely charming and they're very frequently offensive.
Let's talk about the State Department for a second. You once said that.
This is going to be the shortest tenure for a diplomat.
You made it a while now. You once said that the Chicago mayor job was better than all the others put together. Like, how does this compare to your past roles?
Look, one is on that quote. I've always said that there's, David Axelrod and I frequently say this, there's five great jobs in public life in America: president, governors of either New York or California, and mayors of either New York or Chicago. And I jokingly say I've had one and a half of those jobs, and I'm okay. The way I test a job is, are you learning and are you contributing? And this is a great job because I feel like I'm contributing in many ways to the U.S.-Japan relationship and to U.S.-Japan posture in the region. And I'm constantly, every day, learning something new. So I find it very intellectually and emotionally and psychologically stimulating and enriching. Not like my Wikipedia page is empty here. So it's a great job. Yeah. And it's a great job at this point in my career.
So let's talk about contributing. I think you bring a very different energy to what a lot of the State Department seems to hire and optimize and choose for. Like, does U.S. diplomacy suffer from a deficit in personality? Like, if you...
Well, you can't have a 250,000 people with personality. For a color to stand out, you need a little gray somewhere. So here's... Look, my big thing is y'all who cover it think diplomats are in one place and political people are in another. And I would say to you, if you go back and look at history or look at people that were very successful on the international arena, they have a pretty apt appreciation of politics.
Sure.
Jim Baker comes to mind, but you could also go back to John Burns under both Roosevelt and Truman, who was pretty shrewd political player when you go, I mean, underwritten about, but underappreciated how influential it was with those two presidents. So not everybody can be colorful, and nor do you want everybody to be colorful. On the other hand, what you don't want to create is a permissive environment where it's so risk-free, all you're doing is writing memos.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want 100 people trying to go create things. On the other hand, you don't want to distill it down to the basis where you totally penalize anybody to either take a risk or try to make something. The goal here is not to get another meeting to write another memo, The goal here is, in other jobs I've had, like I said here when I first got here, we're going to get it on a plane at some point. You're going to turn around and you want to make sure that when you were here, you put your thumb on the scales and you zipped it. It's not just to write a memo about a meeting.
Has your view on donors getting ambassadors changed after having done the job?
No, I mean, I think it takes all types. I mean, I think, first of all, there's the political ambassadors come in two stripes. The one you just mentioned, financial supporters in the campaign. And then people like myself who ran for office, held office, Senator Tom Udall in New Zealand, former Mayor Eric Garcetti in India. And then that's one. And then the other side is career, and you have two, people that work their way up, and then people who work their way up in a region and have regional expertise. I have come away, I was just actually bizarrely talking to my DCM about this, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and I don't think I could be, whether you think I'm good or not, ambassador, whatever effectiveness I get, because I have a great team, I have a great DCM, but two people I've gotten to know that I really, really enjoy not only spending time with, but I learned from, Ambassador Phil Goldberg in Korea, Mary Kay Carlson in the Philippines, both are career, but there are donors also, and, you know, some of them, you know, who I know well and are contributing in their role. So it depends. It's really not about your background. It's so much as about what you do with the job and what your purpose is with the job.
What do you think the national security state does well and does poorly?
Well, that's like a whole separate podcast.
We got time.
No, well, you do. I don't. I got a day job. Look, I mean, let me just take this region and in this moment. I think the administration, particularly on the national security apparatus, has a vision of flipping our role in the Indo-Pacific from a hub-and-spoke system to a lattice work. And when you assemble giving Japan the confidence to up their defense budget, counterstrike, rewrite their export laws, their national security, you look at the trilat with Japan and Korea, Japan, the United States, and the Philippines. You look at what we've done with engaging India in the region. You look at how we've engaged the Philippines and their island and our access. You look at Vietnam making us a strategic rating. You look at AUKUS. That is a lot of furniture in 2 years. Mm. Unbelievable amount of execution. Assiduously and persistently pursuing a singular goal of changing the American posture in the region to be a better deterrent. So that would be good. And not just good, really good. And brought a lot of coordination between the Defense Department, State Department, Commerce Department, etc. What I don't think, this is going to get me in trouble, I think our military-industrial enterprise and enterprises do not realize and how much their weaknesses impact our political and diplomatic and our strategic endeavors. And we have to fix an entity that can't meet a timeline or a budget. And it has real implications, not just on this deterrent side. It has real implications on the political diplomatic side because it's about trust. And so that would be a place that really needs to pick up their game.
I had it here as a pitch for you for your next thing to take on is defense acquisitions. So,
well, I you got a bat? Because that's what it needs. So, you know, and it's also about, you know, you say that overall, but you got also got, you know, I know this enough as a chief of staff and a mayor and DCCC chair. You got to have good people. You got to have good people in the right place with a certain sense of mission, not just, you know, you're not here to get a job done and go home at five. You got to have a mission and a purpose and understand the value in the larger scheme of things. So that's what I would say we do well and that we need is short. The other thing is we, and I'm a 100% believer in the president's view that allies are an asset and a tremendous advantage America has. But, you know, you can't have alliances without allies. And you got to treat them as allies, friends, and partners. And there's sometimes we have good days at that, and sometimes we have bad days at that.
Talking about good people, Mike Gallagher's calling it quits.
It's a loss for America.
You know, what is there anything that can be done to make Congress a place for people like him to want to stay?
I mean, you're talking to an individual that left after, I got elected to four terms, left after three to go chief of staff. Look, first of all, Mike's a friend. We text as recently as three times today. My prediction is Mike Gallagher is going to be back on the field contributing to the better. Now, we don't agree on everything, but on the overall premise that public service is honorable, we 100% agree. And I think he is a real asset to the United States. And this is not the last we've heard of him. That's my prediction. And I hope he comes back to public life.
Yeah, I guess a broader question, though, like, look, the Koreans...
I know what the broader okay. question is, look, you have... Congress has a level of dysfunction. And it's not on every party. It's not I hate all the journalists that go, oh, pox on both your houses. That's just not true. It's just not true. There's... you have to be at one level, if you're running for Congress and you're serving Congress, you have to believe in the function of government. And you have people in governmental positions that don't believe in the function of government. Well, that's a breakdown. And that's not equally shared in both parties.
How Are you worried how lasting?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm Jewish. I'm worried. I don't even care. Name the subject. I'm worried. Go ahead. What's the subject?
I was going to go Lattice and Trump in Asia. The future of American alliance networks in Asia.
It is hard to move a rock uphill. That rock comes down very fast. And certain people, you know, the president really believes and has worked hard, and I've seen it firsthand, at building alliances and building up allies. And if you're not doing that, it doesn't just, nothing stays stagnant in life, in politics. It comes down. It's either going up or it's going down, but there's always velocity. Always.
So a number of big accomplishments you've had in Chicago and in here as well have required bringing in corporate or philanthropic support. What advice do you have to other leaders thinking about cobbling those things together? Like, what's your secret for getting tens of millions of dollars out of people?
Well, if I told you that, you got to read the next book. No, you got to buy it. I mean, there's secrets in the sense of knowing what's in somebody's self-interest, et cetera. But that said, I also have a Rolodex that I've had for built up over 30 years of things, public service, and I've put it to use. But nobody's going to give just because I or supported AI research or quantum computing or between the University of Chicago and Tokyo, unless they have a confidence and a trust. I can't keep coming, you know. You have to have that. And so when you call a CEO and you say, look, I want to talk to you about, first, they got to have a self-interest. You got to appreciate that and respect it. And then therefore make an appeal to that self-interest in our collective interest. And third, they at some level, since I'm the other person on the phone and I'm the face of this and the voice of this, they got to have trust that this has value, not just to them, but to the overall mission.
Biggest what-ifs in American politics over the past 30 years?
I don't know. Sure.
What are the, like, forks in the road we could have gone down? What are the things you think about? Oh, man, if only, you know, this or that.
So we get TARP is passed under Bush. We have this big fight in the Obama years. And the fights, you know, how to interpret it, how to implement it, et cetera. We, in the early days, very early days of the president's administration, passed what the stimulus bill, the Recovery Act, whatever you want to call it. That's another $800 billion. Nobody had ever done dollars like these two. $800 billion here, $750 billion. It's big money in 6 months.
Yep.
There was a big discussion in the White House then about the three initiatives by the president. One is healthcare, one is financial banking reform, and the other one is climate. And I was, and these are what you make decisions about. And, you know, at that point, just as the stimulus bill's passing, you're beginning to get the first Tea Party. I argued strongly, and we had, to the president's credit, he asked for a meeting. We had a big discussion. I argued for doing financial reform first because I thought that the political system, the society needed to see bankers held accountable.
Sure.
And I thought, as I said then, and I repeat, my quote was, we need some Old Testament justice. That's what the country needs. We, you know, put the bankers in the middle of the public square and just literally beat the crap out of them and reform the system that needed reform. Appropriately, people said that if we didn't do healthcare now, the clock would run out on healthcare. And that is, and if you look at the Clinton era, that's true. My argument against doing that was, first, was unlike in financial reform, bankers were going to be on the other side of the table. To pass healthcare, the lesson out of Clinton's tenure was the health insurance industry, the doctors, the lawyers, the doctors, hospitals, and pharmaceutical industry had it brought to your side of the table. So you didn't have a natural enemy except for the system. And the president made the calculation between time, politics, policy, goals, objectives. He went healthcare first, and the kind of early stages of the Tea Party explodes, and you feel it in the 2010 midterms. But you also feel it beyond. And you could argue, which is my view, and that doesn't mean I'm right, I'm just giving you my view, I think I'm right, that had we done something that dealt with the unaccountable financial industry and holding them accountable for having done what they did to people's homes and their value and their retirement and their economic security, our American politics would not be filled with the rage, resentment that it's filled with today. Now, I'm saying that on the eve of the anniversary of healthcare reform, and it's better that people have healthcare. But like one of the things that is not always appreciated, everything is weighing equities. Lots of people have healthcare. Lots of children have healthcare as a son of a pediatrician. Children have healthcare. It's been better for their health. I'm not sure it's been that great for the political health of the system. And at the time, this little thing called the Tea Party has mesticized and grown to a politics filled with rage and anger and resentment. I think what I was proposing would have dealt with that at an early stage. Did I predict then that it would come to where we are today? No. So that was a road not taken. I think the second road not taken, and I join President Clinton in this, and I think the Palestinian people are better than the Palestinian leadership. The Palestinian leadership has constantly used the Palestinian people, their aspirations, and their desires for their own power rather than for their own aspirations. And what was missed at Camp David when Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat was there, what was missed when right on the heels of Oslo, the bombing of buses in Tel Aviv while you had just made a peace agreement, destroyed any element. I mean, it's hard to think that in Israel in the early mid-90s, there was support, over 60%, for a two-state solution. Today, you couldn't get 2 cents for the two-state solution. When you think about either putting down the gun and making peace work, or in the final days of the president's administration at Camp David, to try to come to the agreement that Arafat said no to. I think those are roads not taken, but not by us. That we not only gave a road, we gave a GPS system, Google, we filled up the tank, we were the Uber driver, we did everything you could. But I'm serious. I think when you look at, you're doing this interview 5 months, look at 2006, Hamas gets elected. There wasn't a single Israeli inside Gaza. They could have built not a tunnel. They could have built a school. They chose tunnels. They could have built hospitals. They chose tunnels. At some point, it's a road not taken.
So what are you, picking up on those two, what are you more optimistic about? America's body politic healing itself or some solution?
I do think, I'm optimistic about both. Otherwise, I wouldn't get out of bed.
Okay.
I'm not overly optimistic, but I am. I actually think you could see right now on the heels, with some leadership shown by the Arab world, the greater Arab world, Muslim world, by Palestinian leadership, by Israeli leadership, the world is ready to get past this moment into something more serious. And I actually think you got to get the short term is the difficult. The long term is self-evident. I think as it relates to America's body politic, it will not heal unless it has a doctor. And I think, I'm a fan of the president's, and I think he has tried hard at that healing. But it's not going to be, this is not a short-term thing. The American people have a right to be, not because of healthcare over financial services. The antecedent to that is you had two moments in the early turn of the century. One is the deception that led to the Iraq war and the lack of accountability for that deception. And two, the deception in the financial industry that led to, and no accountability that led to the loss of people's life savings in their home. And that two moments changed our politics. And there's going to take a lot to regain the trust and confidence of the American people. And they have a right to be angry.
What's the history book you want to write? Pause time for 2 years. You get to hang out in the archives.
No, you know, I've gotten, you know, if you notice, I've written two books. One is, both are on policy or both, you know. I don't want to do, you probably picked the right topic, let me say it that way, history. I really don't want to, I've been approached about doing these kiss and tells. Oh, you've worked for three presidents. I will never do that. I will never do that. It's an honor to be have the confidence of three presidents. I'd rather go to the poorhouse than trade on the trust and friendships and the experiences I've got. I think it's been an honor to serve the country, honor to serve the three presidents, and I've learned a tremendous amount. The history book, if I had to write any history books, is you've had different, look, I mean, you had, Kissinger just wrote a book on leadership. You could argue Kennedy's book, A Profile in Courage, whether he wrote it or not, was about leadership.
Sure.
I would like to say that things that I have seen that tell a bigger story about both leadership, historical moments, to get them in the right kind of context and placement. And I went a little, set the record straight, because there's a lot of mythologies that get built up about things.
Is there a bureaucracy from history or a leader you would have loved to have worked for?
Is there a leader, not a bureaucracy? There is no bureaucracy ever. There's like from world history?
Yeah, sure.
Or
anything?
Oh my God, what I would do to be a fly on the wall with Abe Lincoln throughout now. I suppose in American history, Abe Lincoln would have been, if you could be a fly on the wall in any person, that would be it, probably. I'll just stop there, because okay. I don't want to, there's like a thousand of them.
Okay.
That's good enough.
Do you have parenting advice for Japanese couples skeptical of having children? Or me, I'm getting a kid in 3 months.
You're not getting a kid.
They're arriving.
That's not.
They don't come on Amazon.
There's no prime time delivery. That's not how this works. And if that's how you view it, we have a lot of work to do with you in 3 months. Okay. I actually look. I mean, I'm incredibly fortunate to have three really, really, and it's not just fortunate, healthy children. And when I say healthy, I mean both intellectually, emotionally, psychologically. I actually think it is the most rewarding and most frustrating. There are things to do as a parent, and I think it's really underappreciated. One is, I mean, everything I know about parenting came from this guy called Dr. Ben Emanuel, Marsha Emanuel. And if you don't have good role models, very hard to be a parent. And second, you got to work at it. Third, there are things to do that matter. I think quality time is BS.
What does that mean?
I think it's total BS. There's no such thing as quality time. There is time present with a child that's valuable versus other time, but it's not quality time. You can't box off something. We did little things like we made an effort, more right than wrong, more consistent than inconsistent, of four dinners a night as a family, Shabbat, Sunday nights, and then two during the week, no matter when I was either mayor, chief of staff, etc. We used to have a summer reading list, and at the end of the summer, you had to do a book, you had to do a dinner where you kind of reported on the book you read and led a discussion of the family. We took, when I was mayor, chief of staff, I got in trouble when I was mayor, but I didn't care. We always, for 20 years consistently, mid-March, past the new, took a family vacation. So my job wasn't always impacting the family, and I was more a father than I was either mayor or chief of staff and always being disturbed. I think there's, when our kids were doing homework, I would do my reading in one of their rooms. So you were present. It wasn't a forced type of thing. There's other things to do. I mean, I took each child on a vacation, just one of the children and myself on a holiday So there was no appellate court. There was no sibling stuff. And, you know, and then I think probably the most important, those are little tactical things. The most important thing is build a home of love. And if you have love and an education, a kid will survive and do and thrive. I think we underappreciate. My dad used to have this phrase, and I think the more I think about it, he's never met a child that was spoiled because you told them you love them too many times a day. If you give a, not just tell them, but show them that you love them, not buy them things, but you appreciate them. I think the rest of it takes care of itself. It's not, it's very complicated, but straightforward.
How do you think Ari would do as ambassador to China?
I think the question is, how would China do if Ari was the ambassador?
Well, you think you think he could do a TPP? Like, what's his?
I think my brother Ari has found his niche. Let's just say that. In the same way that I would do horrible at entertainment.
You couldn't take on Dana White.
I just wouldn't have no patience for those type of egos.
Oh, you think they're worse than the ones you got to deal with here?
Yeah.
How so?
Here? Japan? No. Oh, no. I'm not going to. That would just get you in trouble, but yeah.
You taken kabuki dance lessons?
No.
Okay. You seen Shen Yun?
No.
Okay. There's ballet in it.
I got it.
Okay. I got three books for you.
Okay.
So the first one, Emergent Tokyo, by Joe Reynolds. It's like it's sort of like an urban history of Japan. Kind of.
Oh, cool.
Explains like why you have all these little houses. Second one by Alan Liu. I don't know if you come across him. He's like the Zen rabbi.
Alan Liu,
yeah, he has like a short famous book about the high holidays, but a longer one which is a memoir about how he got into Japan and Zen Buddhism. Mm-hmm. The last one, Hollow Crown by Elliot Cohen. It's
Hollow Crown,
yeah, Shakespeare in Power. It goes through all the plays and sort of
the Hollow Crown. Okay, I'm reading right now. My brother and I are reading right now, The Crisis of Culture. But that sounds like a good rap. I'll take that one. Of three, you got one. Okay. That's a win for you.
All right.
Okay.
What's
the Hollow Crown?
Hollow Crown. Yeah, we'll send it over.
Okay.
What's your favorite Japan book then?
I there's a lot I've read on U.S. Japan, China. Regional stuff that I think is valuable books.
What have you learned from Shakespeare about power and politics?
Well, I think on Shakespeare on power and politics, I would say not everything that you think appears as it is what it is.
What do you want to learn next?
What do I want to learn next? Well, I'm learning every day. I mean, I read every day to learn something every day. So I'm not trying to set this topic, but I think I still grapple with like this book on crisis of culture that I'm just starting. It's by a French political sociologist. How did we get to this moment in our this quote unquote woke culture? Understand it without condemning it. That's what the attempt of the book is. I'm kind of fixated on, it's in from 1999, where America is the unipower and seen as this, when you go back and look, its economy was rolling. It was a power that could make peace in the Middle East and da-da-da. It's 2024. That's only 24 years. Like in history, that's a blink of the eye. Mm. How do we get to where we are today, both as a society and economy and in the global place? And I think the other thing I would try to learn, besides we all talk about power politics, I think one of the things underappreciated for the next 20 years is, yes, you can talk about the U.S.-China rivalry, U.S.-Russia, NATO, East-West, liberal versus autocratic. Those are all valuable. I'm not judging them. I actually think besides climate and, let's say, pandemics, I think the big threat, and you're seeing it in real time, is non-state, sub-state and anti-state actors. And to me, that's going to be something to get your hands around. You just saw it in Moscow, and you're seeing it off the coast of Yemen, and you saw it in Gaza Strip. Yeah. And to me, the sub-state, non-state, and anti-state are not the same thing, but they have the same consequences. Okay? I gotta run. I gotta go bone up on Shakespeare for my next book.
Rahm Emanuel, thank you so much for being a part of China Talk.
That was like one China and a lot of other things. All right, thanks.